Okay. Disclaimer, before we start this discussion, it's essential to know that we're talking about a very heavy topic. The flyer probably gave that away. So it's related to suicide and mental health. We acknowledge that these topics can be quite heavy and can also evoke some triggering thoughts or distressing thoughts for some listeners. So if you or someone you know needs immediate support or guidance, please seek mental health and helplines in your areas. Your well-being is very important, and we urge you to prioritize that self-care throughout this conversation. Welcome to the Multiple Podcast. My name is Mo. I am the host of this podcast, and today we'll be talking about suicide, especially how to safeguard preteens from suicide. According to the World Health Organization, suicide ranks as the second leading cause of death among those that are aged between 15 and 24 years globally. So today we're diving into this crucial topic with a panel of experts dedicated to understanding and addressing this pervasive issue among today's youth. And our distinguished panels, they bring a combined wealth of experience and expertise, both personally and professionally. So as we discuss this, we'll tease out some tips that will be helpful for not just the individuals who may be at risk, but also their loved ones, so their guardians, their parents, friends, teachers. So it's going to be very, very all-encompassing. Our very first panelist I would like to introduce is Jessica Puri. Originally Nigerian, she's a wife, a sister, and a daughter, and a wonderful friend of mine. She received a Bachelor of Science in Biology from Loyola University, a Master's of Public Health from DePaul University, and doctoral degree from Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. She's an instructor of public health at Northwestern University and DePaul University. She's also a content writer for Kuth, a global mental health app, sorry. Her research interests are in health equity, mental health, and advanced childhood experiences, which we'll call ACEs. And she's also particularly interested in gender-based violence and female genital mutilation and cutting, which if you've listened to this podcast a lot, you know she's not new to the podcast. As a lecturer and writer, she enjoys simplifying complex topics and making uncomfortable subjects into conversational pieces for any audience. Our next panelist I'd like to introduce is Doc Ayomide. You've known him a lot on the podcast. He used to serve as a one-time co-host as well. He's a wonderful old friend of mine, and he's a writer and a psychiatrist who spent over a decade thinking, writing, and speaking about what it means to be human through the lenses of behavioral psychology, culture, and faith. He has been featured on various Nigerian radio and TV stations, on international media, including HuffPost, and he's been invited to speak at the TEDx. He had his medical and psychiatric training in Nigeria and now lives and works in the UK. He enjoys reading fantasy fiction and theology texts. You can say hello to him on Twitter or shoot him an email on hello@docayomide.com. Last but not the least is Dr. Mathero Michelle Nkalamba. She's a native of Malawi. She grew up in Lilongwe, which is the country's capital, alongside her seven siblings. She pursued her education in psychology, obtaining the Bachelor of Arts in Humanities from the University of Malawi, an MSc in Clinical Psychology from Bangor University in the UK, and a PhD from Rhodes University, supported by the Bates Trust Scholarship. So the Bates is similar to a Rhodes Scholarship, but it's really mostly for those in Zambia and maybe Malawi. She also specializes in global health, mental health, by focusing on preventive mental health approaches. She provides psychological support, psychosocial support, in high-risk settings, and employs what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, alongside other methods. She ensures ethical research practices through her involvement within Malawi National Commission for Science and Technology, and she explores topics like HIV and mental health. She's dedicated to advancing mental well-being and ethical research standard as a chartered psychologist and registered clinical psychologist. As you can see, all these people are very loaded, you know, both professionally and personally. So please, everyone, join me in giving a warm welcome to our esteemed panelists. And thank you so much to have you on the show. It's such an honor. All right. I guess let's just start with Jessica. You kickstart this as a pace setter, because I remember, and I should also say thank you, because you inspired this conversation. If you recall, when you came on the podcast, you briefly touched on it, and I was like, wait, what? I did not know that about her. You had shared on one of your episodes that at 8, you attempted suicide. And I won't lie to you, kind of took me aback, because not that you can ever predict anyone who is at risk of suicide, right? But just hearing your story and seeing how you've, you know, made so much out of your life, it really, really, it was very inspirational to hear that. And I thought this would be a time to kind of expand on that. So can you share your story and, you know, basically maybe tell us a little bit about your family background, what led on to that incident, and what was your family response to that?
Thank you so much for having me here. It means a lot. I was reflecting on just that time of life and thinking about the fact that we're approaching the holidays. So this is just so incredibly timely, because I don't know what it looks like in the rest of the world, but in the part of the world that I'm in right now in the US, suicide rates across the different ages are typically very high around this time. So I'm so glad that we get to talk about this now. So I was born and raised in Nigeria. I am a Northern girl through and through. I talked to my parents about this, actually. I was telling them a few days ago. It's like, you know what, I'm about to share all of this, you know, a bit more extensively publicly. I think you should know some of the details. Or so we talked about it, and they were undoubtedly surprised, right? My dad's first question was, where was I? You know, like, wait, I don't understand. Where was I? Which I really appreciate that, because I realized he and my mom were asking that, but they were asking it not just physically, where were we, but like mentally, emotionally, where were we? How did we miss this? Which speaks a lot to what was happening at the time. So I am the oldest of three daughters. I grew up always hearing, never from my parents or from other people around us, that our family was not complete. Like, we needed a son. It was very normal for fathers to show up with a new wife so that she can produce sons for him if the first doesn't. So there was already this natural pressure that came with being the firstborn, because I felt I'm the daughter and the son. I need to carry on as much as I can to make my family proud. In fact, the first time I saw Mulan, I, like, of all the Disney princesses, I related the most to her. I was like, she's doing what she has to do to bring honor to her family. And I was like, I don't see the problem. So the idea of honor and caring, not disappointing your parents was very much part of the rhetoric. Every Nigerian movie would tell you, yeah, don't disgrace me, don't disgrace me. So it was very much part of the rhetoric then. I have very educated parents who were flawed, but did their very best. And part of doing their best was, my dad was away a lot for work, and so my mom took more of the child rearing. And out of her frustration and all of that, she would hit me. And she realizes it now and back then, but she admitted to me a few years ago, she was like, that was child abuse. I'm like, yes, it was. Which is a big deal for a Nigerian mom to admit. But amen. It was, yes. So there was that, like, so I was living in fear. I was constantly, you know, trying to manage expectations and all of that, because I would be whooped for the littlest things. And I remember asking my mom one time if there was anything I could ever do to make her happy, because I felt like whatever I did would, you know, trigger some kind of negative response. When we were talking about this a few days ago, she was like, yeah, I actually remember you asking me if you needed to pass all your exams for me to love you. And, you know, for her, it was like, well, no, obviously not. It's fine. But it was my way of trying to gauge, like, what do I have to do to be hit less? What do I have to do to receive love? At the same time, you know, I'm like watching these movies and seeing parents hug their children and talk to their children, but I wasn't getting any of that. And so all of that kind of started to build into this, man, I can't do anything right. And at some point it was these whispers in my head that were like, well, if I'm not here, then things would just be easier for everyone, because I just seem to be irritating everyone, you know. I seem to not be enough. So my dad is not staying around. He needs to go somewhere else to work, or he seems to enjoy his work better. And my mom is just so tired of us and all of that. So All of those things were building into the feeling of just not feeling enough and not feeling like I was wanted or loved or like I was supposed to be here. We lived in, Dr. Michelle, you mentioned fresh food. So my mom had turkeys, she had pigeons, rams, cows, all of that. And we had two massive mango trees and one guava tree. And I remember seeing like imagery of suicide in movies. And it was like something with like someone knocking over a chair and hanging. And I thought, well, that seems like the fastest way to get this done. I didn't think of the weight of that. It was just, I was so focused on just making things easier for everyone that I was like, okay, if I just do it like that, it's not messy. And you know, they'll find my body and they'll be like, okay, well, you know, life goes on. So for some reason I picked the guava tree. If I had picked our bigger mango tree, I mean, that tree was massive. It was established. It like, it had to be hundreds of years old. It was very sturdy. The guava tree, not as much. And I remember being alone in our backyard. I had my plan. I had this little plastic chair that I was going to use, all of that. I had the rope, all of it. And you know, I put it over the guava branch. And by the time I like put the rope across my neck and released myself or kind of knocked the chair over, the branch broke and I fell. And my first thought was, I can't even do that right. And I was like, okay, I just got to pack and went about my day. And forgot about the rest of, kind of moved on from that. Like, okay, well, I can't successfully delete myself. So I guess life just goes on. Never really talked about it with anyone until I think it was almost a decade later when I was living in the U.S. That memory came back and I was kind of starting to unpack the reality of my childhood and growing up in the North, but also going to boarding school for 6 years and navigating what all of that did to my mental and emotional health. But I think I'll kind of wrap it up there, but that is what led to the attempt. But obviously I'm here.
Wow. I mean, there's so much to really unpack from there. Thank you for sharing that story. And I also really loved how you expanded on your mom's, your parents' response of where were we? And I feel like sometimes as parents, we're in these fugue states where we just try our best day to day, but we really don't realize the impact some of our actions. I mean, growing up, we were hit as kids, and kids will have different reactions to that. And I imagine you grew up in a very, very loving environment. And saying that, you know, all of that still came from that. So you mentioned something earlier as well as how during this time of the year, you know, holidays are quite, you know, sensitive, even though the goal is to spend time with your family during Christmas and Thanksgiving. But you see that those rates are, the rates of mental health issues and suicide, and especially being with some family members, can trigger some thoughts. So I know you really relocated to the, you moved to the US when you're young. I think you were 17 or so when you moved here, right?
Yeah.
How did you do that? I mean, like being by yourself and alone without support. Undoubtedly, that was very challenging. How were you able to safeguard your mental health during this time? And I know there's a spirit of a lot of Africans sending their kids, you know, over here to get better education. Sometimes the kids are just left with their devices. 17 is awfully young. Some might, you know, fare better than others, but it's too young to be in a place. So how were you able to do that? And when you talked about the feelings of suicide coming back again, what were some safeguard measures that you had to protect yourself during those times?
It was quite a few things. So as far as support, I wasn't necessarily completely alone. I had family friends here who were Nigerian, Hausa speakers who like did everything they could to make me feel at home. So during the holidays, so if it was Thanksgiving or Christmas, I would just take the train to go to the south side of Chicago to be with them. So their presence was just, it was really a gift. I will say though, there was this almost a cognitive dissonance that was happening where I wasn't thinking about my mental health. It was just like, you have come this far. You are the first in your family, as my nuclear family, because both my uncles or two of my uncles schooled in Egypt. But I was the first, I guess, the first in my family to come this far for school. So it was like, don't embarrass them. Don't embarrass them. Like, whatever it is that you're dealing with in your mental health, that can wait. We're going to push that to the side because you have a job to do. Your job is to come be a student, represent your family, and just deal with whatever the mental health challenge is. Like, there will be a time for dealing with that. And that is not the healthiest approach. If I could have done things differently, I would have. If I knew then what I know now, I would have been a lot more open with my family. But back then, it was very much the just grin and bear it, because there's work to do.
All right, thank you for that. Real quick, as a rounding off your session, would be casting your mind back to those times where you had the most difficulty, right? What words would you have liked to hear from your present self to your younger self, looking back?
It's a good question. So, a few different things. So a huge part of my story is my faith, right? So even the way that I ended up in the U.S. involved dreams and visions. And it was there were very specific things that I prayed for that I knew, okay, Lord, I'm your child, so you're going to protect me and all of that. However, there was a legalistic part to my faith that didn't allow me to be as raw and honest in my faith as I could have been. And so if I could say something to my younger self, it's okay to tell God that you feel confused, that you feel lost, and you feel forgotten. Because God is not too scared. He's not scared at all. He's not surprised at your questions. He's not confused by your questions. So I would push myself to be more honest and to practice some vulnerability, because that does not come with the culture.
I love that. I think compounded with your position as a first daughter and depression, and you just feeling like you have to be that model for your parents and even your siblings, I can definitely imagine that complexity. Finally, because I'm sure he will have some questions. And I hate to ask it this way, because the signs are usually often not so subtle. Do you think there were signs that you were giving up but people didn't see? I mean, what are some of the signs, or what are additional things parents or guardians need to know to watch out for?
I think it was the kinds of questions I would ask that could have been the signs, right? So I was looking for signs of being loved and signs of feeling enough. And so I would ask things like, do I have to do this? Or how do you feel when I do this? Right. So it's trying to kind of pull something. And when I was even younger, younger than college age and as a secondary school, it was in the things I would do, right? So I didn't have Munchausen syndrome, but I would want to be sick so I could see some kind of reaction, right? Some kind of nurture, reaction, right? Yeah. And I realized, thankfully, it wasn't Munchausen, because I would not make myself sick. But there was that desire to be like, man, it'd be great right now if I had some kind of health issue, So the signs are very subtle, and I think they show up differently in different children. I don't think there's necessarily a template that fits all. And Dr. Michelle, I'm sure you can speak more to this. But as the oldest child who had more of an avoidant personality, because I didn't want to feel like a burden, I wasn't presenting in signs the way that a more anxious child would, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Wow. Thank you so much, and we'll be right back with you. But let's go on to Dr. Ayomide. Starting with you, what sparked your interest in psychiatry? I feel like I already know the answer to that question, but for the sake of people who don't really know it yet, and while you're answering that, could you shed light on the complexities surrounding preteen mental health and suicide prevention?
Thanks for the questions. And thank you again, Jessica, for sharing that story. I feel like, because I remember hearing the shorter version of the story, and thanks for going into a bit more detail on what it felt like and how you got to that point. Especially because, in what sounds like a really difficult time. How did I get into psychiatry? it's a combination of a bunch of things. One was I've always been interested in psychology, in like, so one of my so funny stories is I read this book on child jealousy when I was like 8 or 9. And it was just because I went to my grandparents. So my grandparents, we used to go to my grandparents every Christmas, and they had a pretty extensive library, and I would always, every time we went there, I would just go to the library and look for a book I hadn't read yet. And because there were so many books and we used to go so infrequently, it took a few years before I felt like, I think I was well into my teens before I was like, do you know what? I think I've taken everything I want. Yeah. I didn't read every single book they had, but like I read everyone. And the interesting thing was, as I got older, I would find books interesting that had been there the whole time, but I hadn't really been interested in. So that was something interesting. So anyway, I picked up this book on child jealousy. I have no idea why. It was a small book, so that probably contributed to it. And it was just very fascinating. I was just about like children being jealous and how that could lead to like regression and how that could lead to like bedwetting. You know, and I was already familiar then with the, you know, issue of like kids bedwetting a bit older than you'd expect. You know, I sort of started thinking, may they be jealous of a sibling? You know, and all that sort of thing. I probably understand a lot of what was in it, but it was enough that I think I was just really curious, like, wow, people are very complex and there's so much going on under the surface. And I was just very curious about that. And then I sort of put it aside because, although I knew that psychology was a job, I did not know until well into my adulthood a single actual human psychologist that was not like on TV. So it never really crossed my mind to study psychology. It was just, you know, also in Nigeria, I was not one of the four sort of, you know, the four career options. And I've heard lots of people from African countries and, you know, some of my Indian and other friends, Asian friends as well, talk about, you know, doctor, lawyer, engineer, failure. Those are your options, right? So psychologist was unfortunately not in that list. And yeah, I think I ended up going to medical school, but I realized very quickly that I was more interested. I remember telling my mom at one point that I realized I'm way more interested in the mind than in the body. But then I didn't know then that I wanted to do psychiatry yet, because I remember feeling like, okay, I am interested in psychology, but psychiatry is like mental illness, right? And I'm more interested in like, why do people do things? and this just feels like, yeah, forget why they do things. We're just going to get to them when they break down. So for a while, as much as I did actually enjoy my psychiatry posting, which is criminally small in medical school, it's like a week. No, sorry, it's like a month in most medical schools. 6 weeks in some places. It's in the current... The hospital where I currently work, we get medical students and they still do 4 weeks. They do 6 weeks, but they do 2 weeks of teaching, so it doesn't really count. So they only spend 4 weeks in the hospital. And yeah, I went into medical school, did the 4 weeks psychiatry posting. It was very short. Just for context, other medical postings are like 3 months. So just to give you an, you know, and which is wild when you think about the fact that psychiatry is something everybody ends up interacting with, no matter the specialty you go to. So you would think you should have a little bit more of an idea of what's going on here. But no. Anyway, so I ended up doing it, and then I didn't get, unfortunately, to do it in my house job year, my foundation internship year, which I think was how some people ended up deciding, oh, do you know, I think I want to do this. But at some point in the year after that, so in Nigeria, you have to do your community service for after you finish uni. And some point during that year, it just sort of fell in place for me. And it fell in place for me in such a very weird way, because it was like, the minute it fell in place, it was like, duh. Like, why was I even considering anything else? And like, this is so obvious. I can't even believe I didn't see it before now. From a Christian point of view, I that's one of those things where I would feel like it was God that just sort of like opened my eyes to see it, you know. But from a psychological point of view, it was just like a sort of like instant moment of clarity, right? So depending on how you want to describe it, and that was it, really. I think I practiced medicine I did my internship year, I did community service year, I did another year in private practice. after that, and then did psychiatry, and I never looked back.
So, oh dear.
So
thanks for that. So what do you think are some of the complexities surrounding, you know, preteen mental health and suicide prevention?
The main complexities are they're preteen.
And you work with them a lot, you know. And
So I've worked in the other weird thing is, I don't know if it's not weird. The same year I graduated from medical school and started like internship, that exact same year I started volunteering with young people, which is a sort of a whole other story why it happened that year. It wasn't connected to graduating medical school, but it kind of was at the same time. But anyway, I started pretty much. So I often like to joke that I've always worked two jobs and one of them wasn't paid. I've done like youth volunteering for as long as I've practiced. And I also like to say to my friends who are parents, because I haven't got kids, but I like to, like, what they lack in, what I lack in depth, you know, I make up for in breadth. Because unless you're a teacher, you're probably not interacting with as many kids as I have. If you're a teacher, you have, and I'm not even going to compete.
Sorry? Finish it. I was going to wrap on that question.
I haven't worked a lot with teenagers as part of my job. So I don't work in the UK, it's called CAMHS. But it's basically like child and adolescent mental health. So it's CAMHS because child and adolescent mental health service is why it's called CAMHS in the UK. And I haven't done a lot of it. I have occasionally interacted with a few young people, but not as like, it's not like the area of specialty I've gone into. But you see some of it, and then you also have to think about what happened to people in their teenagers, even though you meet them as adults. But then, of course, like I said, because of my volunteering, I've seen the sort of low level bits, right? So not like to the level where they need to be in psychiatric care or secondary mental health care, but like, you know, just like, you know, feeling low, feeling bad, feeling shame, feeling guilt, all of this, that stuff. But when I said jokingly, and I was only half joking, that it's because they're preteens, because I think it's mainly just, and this happens with kids as well, like children, like people have this idea that, you know, and they used to say it in Nigeria. I don't know if they said it into people from other parts of Africa on here, but you can let us know if you heard it. But like they often say, what are you worrying about? You're a child, you know, like, I'm sorry. If I'm worrying that my friend is not talking to me as a kid, yes, I know from an adult point of view, it's probably not the biggest thing in the world. But you know what I'm not? I'm not an adult. I'm a child. And this is the biggest thing in my world right now. Oh, it's a kind of story, right? And I think it's this thing where, again, I think working with young people has helped me sort of see this more. It's people forget all the time that they used to be kids. So a lot of what I do in interacting with parents is sort of reminding them, but you know, this is you, right? Like, it's not like this child just did this thing that no child ever has ever done. It's literally what all of us did and what they're doing. Like, this is entirely, you know, like I have two definitions of normal. There's the normal of what you would like things to be, but there's the normal of what normally happens, whether you like it or not, right? And for instance, it is normal that a child will lie at some point. And actually, it's part of their cognitive development. Like, if a child doesn't lie, you should be worried that they are not actually becoming more intelligent. Because lying is basically the moment when they understand that, oh, you mean I can hold back some of the truth and I can change how you think about reality. That's an important developmental, like, area, right? But obviously, you don't want them to lie. I'm just saying, like, but the instinct to lie will come. You know, it's that sort of thing. So that's normal. Not normal in the sense of that's something you want, but normal in the sense of that's something that will happen. And so all of this stuff is normal. And I think adults forget all the time that they were formerly kids, and that kids feel things, and that those feelings are no less strong because they're children, right? Like, the anger is real. The shame is real. The guilt is real. The grief is real when a child loses, you know, something or someone. And all of these things are real. And so a lot of what we can help kids with is just, you know, helping them to name their emotions, helping them to. There's a really good book that the consultant I work with always recommends, which is very, you see why this is funny, to everybody that comes into the team, well, to every doctor. And it's called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. You may or may not know the book. This book appeared in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, by the way, which was very exciting for me. It was a moment. Anyway, but yeah, the point of the book is, even though we work with adults, it turns out that the things that work for kids work for adults. Because kids and adults are both human at the end of the day. Adults are just better at hiding some of those things. Like, adults throw tantrums, but we don't call them tantrums, right? We just say, he's shouting at everybody or whatever. Like at the end of the day, it's a tantrum. Like, do you know what I mean? Adults sulk. Adults do all the things kids do. We just do it in sort of socially acceptable ways. And so it turns out that all of this stuff for kids, and one of the big things in the book is about like helping kids name their feelings, helping kids. And one of the challenges, I think, is that a lot of people become adults and they still don't know how to discuss how they feel, because they didn't learn the language for that, right? And I feel like listening to what you were saying, Jessica, I feel like that was part of what you were struggling with, was you were feeling things and you couldn't talk about them because you didn't have the language to talk about them. And the language that you had wasn't helping you talk about them. And so you couldn't talk about them. And so even if someone had asked you about them, you probably couldn't have said anything, right? Because you didn't have the language. It's like if you don't have the language, you don't have the language. Like, there's nothing you can do. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, I think, but, and then the only other thing I would say, which Jessica also mentioned, is that with kids, you see slightly different expressions of these things. So you don't see the necessarily adult expressions. And so it's especially for younger kids, preteens and children, you know, it can be things as like kids will sometimes say things like what you were saying about the sort of Munchausen's thing. That's actually very common. It's not Munchausen's though, by the way, at that level anyway, for a child. But yeah, kids will sometimes say, well, I feel a tummy pain or something. But actually, it's just because they don't have the language for. I'm not saying that every time a kid feels a tummy pain, they're depressed, obviously. Sometimes a tummy pain is just a tummy pain. Most times, actually. But if you've tried everything and nothing else is working, it's probably worth thinking about helping them with language for how they feel. And a good way to do that, actually, even before they start to feel those ways, is to say, you know, when you see a child demonstrating something that looks like an emotional reaction, like anger, for instance, a good step is simply to say, you're angry, right? Or just like literally say what it is and then say, you know, do you want to tell me why you're angry or whatever? Like, just, you're not, and I think parents and adults in general often fear that they will be telling the kid that's okay. And it's like, no, it's like if someone is bleeding and you're asking them how they started bleeding, you're not saying it's okay that they are bleeding. You're just trying to understand how the bleeding happened, right? And so it's the same. It's just giving them that space to say, okay, why are you feeling this way? What happened? You know, and unfortunately, the first thing we normally do, and sometimes even adults do this, is, well, you shouldn't be angry. It's like, I don't know, maybe it's a little late for that, because you know what? I already am angry.
It's like calm down.
It's like, yeah, like, you know how it is when someone tells you to calm down and they're like, I'm calm. which is always hilarious. Right? It's yeah. So it's like, well, they're already angry. So maybe it's worth thinking about how it's like, again, this may have happened to you as kids. It happened to me. You break a plate and somebody be like, why are you so clumsy? And it's like, I don't know, but like the plate's already broken. Also, it wasn't like it was intentional, so you know, but yeah, it's that sort of thing of like, the thing has happened and it's probably not the best time to talk about, maybe don't do the thing that has already happened. It's probably a more useful time to think about what happened and how did it happen and what are you thinking right now, and then you can get to, well, what do we do next time you're feeling this way?
thank you for that reminder, especially always remembering that this is their first time. Like, and that thing you said about people forget that they used to be once kids, I think that's very, very apt. And then labeling the emotion. So your child is angry or sad, just label, oh, I can see you're sad. Can we talk about it? And then exploring that. I think that's a very, very good strategy. Now, before I move on to Dr. Michelle, I had this question of you. I mean, social media is huge, especially among teens. And you have a lot of kids who were basically babysat through social media and phones and all that. And definitely it can also lead to some behavioral issues. Considering this digital aspect of lives that have, you know, really changed, if you contrast that to how we grew up, how do you recommend parents navigating these situations without straining the relationship they have with their kids? And then you also have issues with bullying and, you know, and then also this pervasive use of social media, especially among teenagers and preteens. How do parents begin to reel those their kids back into that safety without causing that alienation? Because it's, for example, I see a lot of, you know, teens now who are so dependent on their phones and even on social media platforms where they exposed to so many issues with peer pressure, and there's also bullying going on. What are some strategies to help parents, you know, become better custodians of these kids who are maybe often spending too much time on social media platforms where they might be prone to more bullying? And I think Jessica would also like to pitch on this when you're done talking. So that would be nice to see.
Well, I think the big sort of principle, I think, is thinking less. I think with technology, there's a thing where it's easy to focus on the dangers and the risks. And historically, you and I have talked about this a lot. Historically, that's human nature, right? Like, you know, Plato was worried that books would make young men forget how to remember things. Books.
And there was the bicycle.
Right. There was concerns about bicycles and women and all sorts of things that it could do to damage people. There were concerns about cars when cars came. There were concerns about trains. There were concerns about television, personal computers, and smartphones, and social media, and the internet, and whatever else is coming. Oh, of course, and there's AI now, isn't there? That's the new thing everyone's freaking out about. I don't think that's a helpful way to think about things. I think it's more helpful to think about how can I help this person or these people live well, given all of these realities, because these things are reality. And that's it. That allows us to sort of create space for meaningful use and as against sort of harmful use. And I think the problem is sometimes when people come at it from the sort of restrictive mindset, then it's just about how do I limit it? And then that in itself can backfire, as you know, again, I'm sure we all know people growing up who were restricted from something or the other, and then the first chance they got, they went hard the other way and never looked back. Right. And of course that, again, there's all those stories that are human and go back as far as forever. It's just the specific technology or thing is what is different. And yeah, in terms of that, there's a lot of ways to think about it. There are I know iOS, Android, and well, those are the two main ones, aren't they? Windows and Mac OS as well have major sort of screen time things that you can use, which I always say, like, if you're a parent, you have to familiarize yourself with ways of sort of keeping an eye on frequency of use of devices, right? But also, like, what times they're using devices. Especially, I think, as people get into teenage, there's this tendency to use them late into the night, and then that affects their sleep and stuff like that. Now, something I just wanted to highlight is people always talk like, oh, young people are on their phones all the time. I'm sorry, people are on their phones all the time of all ages. Like, this is not a young people problem, right? This is an old people problem. You know, again, everything people look at young people for is really something that we're all doing. Like, adults are on their phones all the time. Adults are on their phones late into the night and not sleeping. Adults, like, do you know what I mean? Now, of course, it's easier to overdo these things a bit because they're younger and they have less sense of risk and all of that. But, like, let's not act like they're the only ones who are having these problems. Adults are consuming all sorts of craziness from this internet and social media and spewing it back to people on the internet and social media and in real life. all the time. So yeah, but I think it's really about just thinking about using these things wisely, using them well, being aware of the risks, and talking to them about what the risks are. I think sometimes people don't want to talk about the risks, but it's like, well, you have to talk about the risks, because if not, then it's not real. And just letting them be aware of that, but also being aware of little sort of basic guidelines, like don't add people you don't know, talk to people you know, that sort of thing. I mean, just use as an example of like how social media can be good. I know some kids who it's their main way of, you know, they play Roblox or Minecraft with their friends and family members across the world, and they're keeping in touch almost every other day through Minecraft and Roblox. Now, they could also be talking to some random people, but I think these particular kids, they've been taught enough and understand enough that that's not a wise thing to do. So it's mostly, as far as I know, it's just with their friends. The other thing is, accept the reality that whatever safeguards you put, kids will try and break them at some point, because that's what kids do. And some of that is intelligence, and you should probably be like secretly happy about it, but never let them know. And some of it is also just like, okay, yeah, you flex your muscles now, but let's be serious. There's actual dangers and risks here. But again, it's sort of like picking your battles. And then also the other thing about thinking about it in terms of helping them live with it is, as they get older, you want to be reducing the restrictions, don't you? So, you know, and then thinking about when that is. And something funny I always find with most parents is the ages for when they introduce or remove certain restrictions goes down as... You know, with the more children they have, the ages go down. But I think that's also a reflection of realizing, you know, maybe I was freaking out a little bit too much to begin with.
Thank you so much, Jessica. You wanted to chime in on this one before we go to Dr. Michelle.
Mo, could you please repeat the question? I want to be sure I don't.
It's about social media use, bullying, and you know, parents becoming more proactive in that regard. Yeah.
Yes. So one of the things I see a lot is parents, and I will post a disclaimer, I'm not a parent. I'm sure there are things that parents can speak to that I cannot yet. But I will say I see several parents falling into this not my kid syndrome, or like NMK syndrome. It was not an original, I heard it somewhere. The disbelief that your child could be the bully, or your child could be could be on the receiving end of bullying. And so out of that mindset, they don't take as much time to learn what their children are learning, because they're adults. They have other things to deal with. So you really can never learn too much of what's normal for your child now, and drop those expectations of what your child could be doing. There are people, like Ayomide was saying, there are people. they're going to do what you probably would have done at their age if you had the same access to social media. But absolutely, the not my kid syndrome needs to go.
That's a good point. Thank you so much. I think there's this meme that you say, oh, my child will never, and then your child would do that same thing, like watch them never do, never, what you say they can never do, or something like that. And that cracked me up. But thanks for that reminder. It's a sober reminder that, you know, we need to be vigilant, you know, because if we're talking about bullying really high, who are those bullying? The kids, you know, it has to be, you know, kids doing the bullying, you know. So what's the odds that sample size would be quite as high as the victims as well? Last but not least is Dr. Michelle, and you have a lot to unpack. So maybe just share a little bit about your practice and the unique approaches you implement, considering that you're set in the very heart of Africa in your lovely homeland of Lilongwe, Malawi.
Thank you. All right. So I think just like any African country, mental health in Malawi is in the pits. So the priority here is physical health. I mean, if you have a broken bone, if you're shrieking in physical pain, that's what, you know, the government prioritizes. So mental health doesn't get much funding as such. We have the psychiatric hospitals and academia, nothing else in between. So I am mainly in the academia. In my psychosocial support work really involves psychoeducation and mental literacy. And just listening to Jessica and Ayomide talk about emotions, just asking basic questions such as, are you angry? I think that's the bit of what I do, that can we just talk about emotions? Can we just acknowledge that we feel angry, that we feel anxious? And just coming back, I don't know what comes first. You know, it's the chicken and egg question. We've been talking about children, but as I was listening, I was like, let's talk about parents, because everything that we're talking about comes down to the parents, their own unresolved traumas, their own fears, their own understanding. For example, the fear of one's in Africa is real. Experience poverty, you don't want your children to experience that. So that's where the pressure comes in, you know, get everything right, get such, you push your children. I've got a 7-year and was young, teaching him ABCs, homeschooling and the like. And as with every boy, really like to read when you force them, all right? So, and then he reached 6, 7, interest, but he does love listening to me read. So, and then I go to school, I feel the pressure, and as is typical of teachers in Africa, oh, you know what, that kid is doing that, him, and he started losing interest in reading. And then I said, wait a minute, and I took a step back, had to work on my fears about what success is. And you know, speaking of social media, everyone's putting on their WhatsApp status if their child draws a pig, even if it looks like a cow. Oh my God, he's such an artist, or stuff like that. And you get pressured. Is my child lagging behind? So I had to sit myself down and say, okay, what are these fears doing to your son? You're lowering his confidence. You're putting pressure on him. He's now disliking what he needs to do. So just to mention that in whatever you were talking about, it's also sort of like digging the root of the problem, that kids, it's the parents' anxieties and fears on their kids. So it's not only our psychological makeup or unresolved traumas, it's the cultural messages we carry that are invalid, all right? So for example, if your kid wants to be an artist, if in your society that if that's not success, we know we have to get over that, all right? Not interested in science, that's okay. If he wants to you know, do something else, do music. We're just discussing with my brother the other day. He said to me, you know, we send our kids to good schools, whether they're posh private schools, but if your child decides to open a bar beside a lake and sell, I don't know, beers, that's the thing. So I just wanted to mention that with emotions, it starts with the parents. And with African communities, having children is like a successful thing. It's like now you're holy. It's like, I can say this as a psychologist, that other people are not equipped to be parents themselves because they're still carrying the trauma. And other people, especially those who have got unresolved issues, are the ones that contribute to the, you know, poor mental. So I just wanted to get out of the way. So my approach is really in that sense, that can we talk about mental health? Can we acknowledge that there are these emotions that need to be addressed? Can we acknowledge that what we do to each other has an impact? Can we acknowledge, can we look at someone and wonder how they're doing? Can we look at our kids and ask them, how are you feeling today? So even just explaining concepts like what mental health is, what does it mean when someone says I'm depressed? What does it mean when someone says I'm anxious? What is making them anxious? What are their fears? And really, I see a big difference. When people say, oh, all right, I remember this other day or this other time when I lost my, you know, grandmother, I was just feeling this way. So I was actually, you know, grieving. So if you put a name, like Ayomide said, if you put a name to what you're experiencing, it's like you've named the monster and you can, you know, better able, you know, to deal with that. So I also tap on the resources that we have. As I mentioned, I'm not going to go into a counseling room, or you're not going to talk to a therapist. So we are in a society where there's a lot of structures for social support. We're actually a very communal society. So if there's a wedding, if there's a funeral, or just gathering. So I also utilize that because to me, social connection is important, feeling that you belong, interacting with people. And in Malawi, it's that sort of country where you'd go into a mini bus or a minivan and strike a conversation with a stranger all the way for 2 hours. You talk like you've known each other for years. And that, you know, understanding each other, just, you know, getting each other, sharing jokes. And at some points, you know, you'd sit in a minibus and just listen to two people converse and, you know, people would just join in. So for me, that instinctive social connection, feeling that we're one. I studied in Bangor in the UK, miserable place. On top of that, I remember days when I would not talk to anyone, right? I would, and you know, after the end of the day, I would think, I haven't even talked to anyone. I went to Morrison's to get my bread. But I didn't really talk to anyone. I didn't have eye contact with anyone. I mean, how would that, you know, make you feel? So I encourage that. And so you might not actually be talking about what's bothering you, but I think that connection with other human beings. So I really like tapping into that. And I also believe that because Malawi is very raw, very natural, that works on our mental health because it's just really a beautiful country, beautiful weather and beautiful people. So despite the adversity, I think it's that sort of country where you can't help but smile, whether it's the people or, you know, what you've experienced.
You know, oh, I think she's frozen. Is she frozen? Just me?
She's frozen. No, not just you. She's frozen. Yeah. And while she's back, while she tries to go back, I think what she said was just so spot on. Are you there, Michelle? Dr. Michelle, are you still there? All right. And I think Ayomide has mentioned the same
Hello?
Thing.
Okay. I was frozen for a bit, right?
Okay.
Sorry.
You're back. Yeah. Please go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Where did I stop?
Just about the natural nature of Malawi. You believe,
yeah.
You believe something about the nature and all that.
Nature. Okay. Yeah. That our natural environment. And in fact, the way we do things, because it's not a very advanced country, so everything is pretty, you know, manual. You carry stuff. You have to ask someone to help you. So there are lots of opportunities to interact. Our banks, I don't know if I should call them, no, I don't want to use the word incompetent, but they're quite slow. So you tend to stand very long times in the line in the bank and just not to get bored, you're chatting up with someone. So it's that sort of environment. The road traffic, it's the same. You want to renew your license, you know, you just take your snacks and water and stand and just chat with people because, yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Michelle said, I think Amina also said, so around parenting, and Amina, you kind of mentioned overcorrecting. I remember a conversation I was having with my therapist, shout out to therapists, a few years ago about my fear of parenting that came from that attempt, right? Like being so scared of repeating the environment that led to the attempt, like so scared of repeating it in my children. And so the overcorrection there was, I'm never having children. And with other people, the overcorrection is, I'm going to have children so I can do everything my parents didn't do. And then because of that, you know, that locked in mindset, you end up inadvertently repeating it because you haven't dealt with the trauma. And I've kind of walked through to what you're saying, Michelle, walking through my own traumas when I think about reproducing, and it no longer gives me, I don't break into a sweat anymore when I think about reproducing. And there was a time that I would have a very visceral reaction to the thought of having children, but there's been so much power in addressing my why with professional help and marrying a person who is very familiar with therapy and who is healthy in himself and has worked through a lot of his own traumas, that is also very aware of mine and continues to create a space for me to to share how I'm feeling in any moment about reproducing. I'm very, very thankful for that. But I'm also so glad you mentioned that, Michelle.
Yeah, and I think it's just admitting as well that parents are also human beings, all right? I don't remember my parents saying sorry to me, you know? But I make
you're
it
African,
point.
What's sorry? It's not in our vocabulary. Sorry, and I love
try.
You.
I try, well, I mean, I tell him that, you know, I'm sorry I was impatient with you because he looks surprised, but I just hope he remembers in the future that, okay, at least my mom tried to say sorry when she was impatient because we're also not perfect. And I mean, we're our authentic selves. When you are tired, you are tired and you're impatient. But I do try to be human, to say I'm not perfect, to say parents are not wrong. You know, because the flip side of that is that they even take those low moments that you have when you make them feel in a certain way. They believe that. But when you show them that I'm sorry, they know that you can make a mistake. And when they grow up, they should comfortably say, my mom was wrong when she made me feel this way or when she said this.
Thank you to all of you panelists. And I also love the, so profound messages you guys have thrown here. And even happening on what you just said last about the social cohesiveness of our cultures as Africans. And I think that a lot of us, until we move to this side of the world, begin to appreciate just the kind of societies we're brought in. Don't get me wrong. I mean, a lot of our countries have some issues with infrastructure and all that. But the way this, I think there's just that beauty of human connection. And I think I already said this a lot on several of our episodes about those micro conversations you have, maybe from your neighbor just saying, fine girl, or you get to the bus stop, somebody just having conversations with you that even if you're not welcoming it, you don't know how the impact of your mental health until you move to a country like here where I might not see my neighbors for like a whole year, you know, because I'm driving in and out of my garage and, you know, we don't talk. You know, and if you move here in your 20s and you're like, why am I depressed all of a sudden? No one talking, no one checking in on you. And that really impacts your mental health. And I know we've talked about traumas and all that and physical abuse. I should also stress the importance of verbal abuse. Those can also play a lot of role, especially when you're older and those are the things you keep playing over and over again in your head. And I think this is the space to acknowledge that, you know, as parents, we have a lot of work to do, but there's also grace. And I think having those conversations, for me, becoming a parent, I've had to really undergo therapy because I would just find myself doing things that I know was very against my own very nature. And there were things I learned as a child growing up, you know, just the instant reaction and just, you know, losing control and giving myself grace and redeeming the situation. My daughter is 4 and I tell her I'm sorry so many times. And she knows that word so much. She's saying it back to me quickly when I'm like, I'm sorry, you know, and I forgive you. I love you. I still love you. So these are some of the things I've had to learn. And our parents, they do their best. But again, the importance of that trauma that you talked about and finding out what makes you tick. I think those are the supporting words that I'll leave today. Now, moving on to our Q&A. And the first question I would like to ask all of you would be this. I mean, first of all, let me ask the question that was posed by one of our listeners, Nelly Pulsar from Zimbabwe. Thank you. She was like, what can you give parents? What advice can you give parents when building their relationships with their children to avoid suicide? So let's start with that.
Can I start?
Sure.
I think for me, it's what I said earlier on. Talk about emotions. Normalize emotions. Don't demonize anger. Don't demonize when a child is crying. And create a psychologically safe environment. By this, I mean an environment where the child is able to express their emotions without feeling that they'll be penalized or without feeling that they'll be told off. Our reaction to a happy child should be the same reaction to a sad child. Easier said than done, because what usually happens when a child exhibits negative emotions, it triggers us. Especially if we have what I already mentioned, some trauma in our background. So if you see a child distressed, and if as a child, when you were distressed, you were shouted at, it triggers that. And your reaction also becomes a trauma reaction. So it's important to learn to respond to any negative emotion as kindly as you would any, you know, positive emotion, so that the child should feel okay expressing both emotions. So like I mentioned, I think it starts with the parents. You know, these conversations never take place when they teach you about breastfeeding, they teach you about changing diapers, they teach you about everything physical and practical, but this just never takes place, to sit down with yourself and say, what are my issues? Even more so when you're coming from two different backgrounds. I'm a single parent, so I don't know, I should say luckily, but there's no parenting style, different parenting style. So you can imagine if you're parents from different backgrounds and you're reacting differently to these emotions, all right? So for some, you may react. For others, they shut down. I know parents who just like emotionally block, you know, their children to say, okay, they're like not even responding when the child is crying. They're looking at them like, you know, a blank face, and the child is confused. So start with your own emotional literacy. What are your triggers? How do you react emotionally? And coming down to actually understanding the emotional issues that children have, Ayomide alluded a lot to those, but just understanding that self-harm or suicide attempts don't just occur. They're usually prolonged mental health issues that haven't been attended to. Depression, anxiety, and as Jessica was explaining, I think her home environment was very highly anxious, where you would be walking on eggshells, second guessing, what should I say, how should I be? So issues like depression, anxiety, when they are prolonged, they build up to that moment. And this is because as human beings, we're not born to tolerate a lot of emotional distress. So as we grow older, we develop that tolerance, what we call distress tolerance, where you're able to sit with negative emotions for some time. For children, that is very low. They can't just contain negative emotions for a long time. They can't be anxious or sad or depressed for a long time. So because they don't have the skills to manage this tolerance, that's when these ideas, the suicidal ideation comes in, the self-harm comes in, the I should just disappear comes in. So that's why it's important to, like I mentioned, just normalize negative emotions. It's okay to be angry, you know, cry, you and to teach them how to emotionally regulate. You know, you can cry and then they learn how to regulate. So it should be normal, even as an adult, when you're angry, to cry. And once you know that you're going to stabilize. But for some, it's like, oh, I can't feel bad. I can't feel like this. Therefore, I should end this pain. And the other thing is just making sure that there are protective mechanisms, because I am more of the preventive, you know, mental side of things. What environment are they growing in? Are there other people around, apart from the parents, that the child can talk to? You know what? Sometimes when I'm angry or when I know that I'm going to lose patience, I tell my help. There's a nice lady, my son's nanny, you know, can you talk to him if maybe he did something at school? So that he has different support systems, or if they're close to an auntie or an uncle. I'm very close to my niece. My sister, at certain points, cannot talk to her daughter, but I'm very close to her. So allow that, because I know African parents were like, you know what, I educated this child and I'm going to make sure that it's about finances, right? I want this child to take care of me. So we're also very possessive of our children, you know? We want them to bond so much with us, but we have to let the child have other sources of emotional support. Even a best friend, it's okay. Don't go like, oh, why are you talking to your best friend, not me? Just allow them to create other sources where they can, you know, find the support.
Wow. Thank you so much for that, especially with the taking stock of our own emotional literacy. And so I would just share something a bit vulnerable. Becoming a parent, I've been able to almost like see myself in a different light, because nothing really shows you how much grace you need as a human being than being a parent. And one thing that really got me, so whenever my daughter would make a mess, was a trigger that just came out for me, because apparently, I mean, I don't like messy areas, but from a child, it was a different kind of trigger. And my reaction was just like, what in the world is wrong with you? Children are like, they're supposed to be messy. It's part of their creative process. But my reaction was always so, and it became so, even as I wanted to start knowing how to wipe. And so I had to start working on that and just maybe looking the other way and having somebody else step in, usually my husband, to really help out. But I found out that it was because growing up, you know, I grew up in a place with housing issues and there was a lot of mess everywhere. And cleaning was my response trauma, my trauma response to that. And then bringing that to my parents. And so, again, it was through parents that I realized that the way I was reacting to my daughter making messes wasn't really normal, but it was what I'd known, and I didn't know that was a part of me until I started parenting. I just wanted to say that to really tag on what you talked about. Like, it starts with the parents, and we should also understand what our trigger is, so that way we can be effective, not just as parents, but as people, period. And I think Ayomide wanted to also put a little bit on this. So Ayomide, you can go for it. Thanks, Jessica, for that comment, by the way.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I'm laughing because obviously, like, I know you enough to know how that would have happened, but it's also a great picture, I think, of the reality of parenting, which is and I think this is the case of our relationship. One of my favorite things to say, you've probably heard me say this many times, is we need other people to know ourselves, right? We can only know ourselves in relationship. This idea of sort of going off into some distance, you know, like, I always imagine, like, if you were to go off into, like, the desert and, like, you know, have this, like, 5-year retreat to know who you are, you'd come back the first day from that retreat and somebody would do something and you realize, like, okay, I didn't know Jack because I wasn't ready for this. And I think the reason why I say that is because I think that it's important to remember that there are some things we will not know about ourselves until we get into some relationships, whether it's, so there are some things you don't know. And for people who are, you know, who have a spouse or partnered, you know that there are some things you didn't know about yourself until you became, you know, sort of together, joined with that person. And there are some things you don't know until you have kids. And if you have more than one kid, you also realize that there are some things you don't know until you have each kid separately. Because actually, each kid brings out some things that you were not ready for. And the reason why that's important is because, in as much as it's useful, I think, to, and so partly to your point, Jessica, about it's useful to sort of think about the things that we're carrying, I think there's a level to which you can't know all of those things. And actually, there are some of those things that you cannot know until you sort of, you know, hit the road and, like, you know, you just sort of figure it out, oh, dang, I have this issue. And you simply can't know. And that's okay. Like, that doesn't mean you're, and that's the sense in which people will tell you that you can never be ready for this thing, right? Because actually, you can only prepare for the things you are thinking about. There are some things you simply would not be thinking about. And so, yes, definitely, we should all do everything we can based on what we know, but then also be accepting of the fact that there are some things you simply will not know. And that, for me, also connects to the other thing about parenting, which is, parenting is not meant to be a two-parent job, right? It's not meant to be like me and my little family, you know. And for me, that's also freeing. For even if you're a single parent, like, look, even if you are one, even if you are two, it still would not be enough people to do this job, because actually, you need a community, right? You need a community to raise any child. You know, it's like that whole, it takes a village. Exactly. Well, I was actually going to share, because I have a lesson I wrote on this, which I'll share at some point. But it takes a village, right? We can't, and I think one of the big challenges is we live in a time when parents have all of this pressure to be perfect and to have perfect children. And, but at the same time, when there's no support for the parents, right? So it's, and is this, and one of the ways I've seen that is, like, sometimes when you see parents, a parent with a child in public, and the way people are looking at the parent, like, you know, and maybe they're struggling a bit, and, like, people are looking and judging. And I think about, like, but in a different context, at least when I grew up, when that kind of thing was happening, it would be people coming around the parent to say, okay, what do you need? How can we help you? Do you want to take a step away and let us help you care for this child? You know, it was like, no, it's our job. It's not your job. I, like, deal with your kid. What is your problem? right? And I think the problem, so for me, and the reason why I say that is because I think when parents struggle with kids, it's easy to start feeling like, maybe I'm not good enough. And like, no, because you're never meant to do this by yourself. So yeah, you are never going to be good enough, if that's your definition of good enough, to do this by yourself. And like, needing people is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of you recognizing how this is actually meant to work, which is actually, you know, so like what you said, Dr. Michelle, like, you know, sometimes you bring your sister in, sometimes you bring the help in. Like, you're pulling around you for support for this thing, because, and like you should not feel guilty about that. That is exactly how you should be doing it, right? And the third thing I just wanted to add is, you know, one of my favorite concepts in psychology, which is the good enough mother, by Donald Winnicott. And it's sort of this idea that actually it turns out that the parents who were doing the best job were the ones who just tried to be good enough. Mm-hmm. And so one of my favorite sayings from that is, good enough is good enough, right? We sometimes think of good enough as like, it's bad. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, it's literally good enough. It's like just, we, I think, and the funny thing about the research was that actually people who tried to be better than good enough ended up making their kids more anxious. And so there's something interesting about aiming for perfection that just actually creates more problems. Whereas aiming for simply like, do you know what? Like, I feel like for any parent, at the end of the day, if you're like, do you know what? Some, like, I like to joke with some of my friends. I'm like, your child didn't die today. You're winning. Like, there's some days when that's all you need, right? And obviously, that's not every day. That's every day. Maybe you need some extra help. But there are some days, and I think every parent will recognize this. There are some days when it's like, do you know what? This child is still alive, winning. It's like, you know, and there are days when it's like, look, like, there's some days when you have a great moment with a child, and then there are days when it's like, do you know what? I didn't scream. We didn't have any great moment, but you know who didn't scream? Me.
Winning.
Hashtag blessed.
No, there's this. So it takes a village. This is, please, I want to hear other thoughts on this, but this is also kind of connecting to the question. I found this irony of like, it takes a village. I grew up hearing that, but where culture and religion kind of intersected with family culture was this, don't wash our dirty laundry outside, right? So, there are things that I know people in my parents' lives will never know about my parents' children. But those people should know so they could speak, you know, directly to those things. But we don't want to embarrass our family. Like, you know, we don't want to make our parents look weak or like they failed. So I find that it takes a village is so much easier said than done. And it wasn't my experience. I didn't see my parents being vulnerable. Like I didn't, but that was also their trauma response to not being cared for well. I realized they're better at this as they're getting older. Cause I was talking with them about this and my dad was like, oh, tell them, like, you know, for the podcast, he was like, tell them that we did not do a good job of being vulnerable and being clear. I was like, well, thank you for saying that. But also, you're in your 60s. If you said that when you were in your 30s, we wouldn't be here. But, you know, but it takes a village. So in my adulthood, now I have to think about what it takes a village really looks like. Because there is that desire for like self-preservation, right? And you want to be a leader. You want to look dependable. You want to look faithful. You want to look like, you know, because you've obeyed God, here's all the good things that you did and, you know, the things that you've gotten right that people can emulate. So I don't know. The idea of it takes a village really, I think it looks different across different familial dynamics. The other thing I will add to, though, in response to the question around parental dynamics is paying attention. And Dr. Rochelle, you said this so well with giving power to emotions. But then the parent who is overly expressive and the parent who is underly expressive creates a child who knows that when the overly expressive parent is in their element, the just their parent is not going to protect them, right? Because they're not trying to get in the way of the overly expressive parent. And so when you have this child who is developing in that
environment, they could either fall into, you know, replicate both sides. So either grow up to continue to never express or to overexpress, or kind of like me, where you just need the right trigger to fall back into that management mode, right? Because you know no one is going to come in to help protect you. And anyway, I hope I'm not rambling at this point, but the idea of that emotional management, I think, is so important, but it becomes so difficult when you have two completely different styles of emotional expression and people who don't necessarily know how to navigate the other person's expression or the other adult's expression.
That's quite deep, especially with the under expressive and over expressive. You think that would mathematically create a balance, but the issues with that. I think Mrs. Tariki had a question and a comment. Mrs. Tariki is one of our wonderful, wonderful African mom and grandma, and she's been on the podcast, and I'm sure she has a lot of wise insights she'd like to share. Mrs. Tariki, please, you can go on and unmute your mic and ask your question.
Hello. Thank you, everyone. This is so productive, great conversation. And I could say I could connect with all of you, from Dr. Puri all the way to the psychologist and also the psychiatrist as well. But this conversation is so great and it's well needed within African immigrant community all over the diaspora, as well as people back home. Dr. Puri, you mentioned something about adverse childhood experience. I didn't know you focus your research on that, which I would love to have more conversation with you about that. I never knew about adverse childhood experience until I listened to a podcast put together by both white and African American. When they initially created this adverse childhood experience, it was based on white experience, not on diversity of people from different background, not even on African-American background. And I would love for you to just explain it a little bit for those who may not know about what adverse childhood experience is. Because I want to ask all the questions for each one of them so everybody will know what they have to answer. And I would love to, you know. So it is great to have such, you know, understanding, because we need more Africans to join in into this kind of research.
Mm-hmm.
To know that we have to understand, how do we design what is adverse childhood experience that is connected to our own cultural background, our own experience, as Dr. Michelle said, growing up in an African community back home, and expectation, you know, which a lot has to do with so many things that is rolling over my head. For Dr. Michelle, I really appreciate you mentioning parents' trauma. Because if parents are not understanding their own experience of what they experienced growing up, how does it affect their children? And I would love you to expand a little bit more when it comes to, I know you're based in your country, Malawi, I believe. How can parents carry that to America or in the diaspora, anywhere they are, in terms of how it affects their children in upbringing? And for Dr. Adebayo, I really commend you regarding psychiatric, you know, care. There's still a lot of stigma attached to actually seeking psychiatric help within African immigrant community in the diaspora, as well as back home. When I first started this podcast of Pansa Pansa, I interviewed a young lady who suffered from bipolar disorder in Nigeria. And she now have her own organization about the stigma associated with mental health when she was going through it, what she had to, how her parents didn't understand what she was going through. So within African immigrants, how can we educate parents to normalize that it's okay if your child is taking psychotropic medication? The same way physical health is important, so is mental health. I always tell parents, your head is the source of your humanity. It's where your eyes located, your nose, your mouth, every aspect of your human being. You know, because deep down, even in Yoruba culture, they will say, Ori Lonishe, that means your head is the sense of your direction of your life. So how can we normalize this kind of conversation? So thank you all for, you know, and I'm going to speak to more Sybil. I think I could invite each one of you
to my go ahead. I can do the introduction. I should have
So thank you so much.
Thank you, we can start with Dr. Piri Jessica. So expanding on adverse childhood experiences, especially seeing how these measures preclude our experiences as Africans, maybe just explain what they are and some of the constructs they measure, and how maybe having a parent in jail might not really be a problem, but we could have other issues as well. So I think that would be a good way to get started. And then I will repeat Dr. Michelle's question and then also Dr. Ayomide's question in case they forget by the time they're about to answer. Thank you.
Ms. Serenki, it's so good to hear your voice. Thank you for that question. So to expand on it a bit, there are multiple articles, books written on this, so we can teach a whole class on it. So I'll just give the Spark Notes version. So we call them ACEs, so adverse childhood experiences, but it became popularized in 96 when Kaiser Permanente in California partnered with Dr. Filetti to essentially try to understand people's, how adversity in early childhood was connected to ill physical health in adulthood. So it was what we call a retrospective study, where you look at people with COPD, heart disease, and all kinds of asthma, like all kinds of conditions, and trying to see if adversity outside of their physical health could have been connected to it. And they found, examples of an ACE would be growing up with a mentally ill parent, or growing up with an incarcerated parent, or an alcoholic parent. So again, you know, the parenting thing plays into this as well. Or your primary guardian, basically the adult who was in charge of you in your early childhood. And it was found that when people had more ACEs in their early childhood, they were more likely to have adverse physical health in their adulthood. One of the major limitations of that original study from 96 was that most of the, like Ms. Serenki was alluding to, most of the participants were male, they were white, and they were of a particular socioeconomic level. And so the study has been replicated over and over again in multiple states in the US and multiple parts of the world to expand on what ACEs could look like. So, for instance, Philadelphia added, if you have been part of the foster care system, that counts as an ACE. If you've witnessed violence, if you've been bullied, that counts as an ACE. I will say, though, specifically with ACEs, they need to be context specific, right? Because some kids will grow up hearing gunshots, even if they were never shot themselves. That is an experience of trauma, and you know, it's extremely valid. What I'm yet to see, and if I had bandwidth for this, I would do it, is examining ACEs among boarding school students in different parts of the world. As I went to boarding school, and when I tell you, we were surrounded by the P words, by pedophiles, and we were surrounded by multiple adults who were not well regulated. But we spent 6 years of our lives living on campus with them 9 months of the year, every year for 6 years. There are multiple ACEs that will come out of that, that kids within the same country that went to day school would not experience, right? So While ACEs are widely discussed, I think we miss out on a lot because we don't go as context specific as we should. But that's a very quick spark notes version of ACEs. And I know we can keep talking about it for a while.
Thank you so much. For Dr. Michelle, so your question was about parenting in diaspora. So if you're able to answer that, yeah.
Yes. So I'm also thinking of migrating at some point. So I also know that I will carry my fears of the new environment because we're talking about parenting in the African setting. We have a different social cultural makeup altogether. So wherever you go, there'll also be a different social cultural makeup that will trigger you. So I'll give an example. You know, let's say in the UK, drinking for 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds is normal. Dressing in, something as short as they want to. Exploring sexuality in ways that are quite quite different from the way as Africans express their sexuality, even religious freedom. So it's now that, okay, you've left one environment, you also be confronted with a different type of things that, you know, trigger you differently. The fears that you may have had in Africa, like, oh, my son or daughter want to get the best education, may not exist in, you know, the developing world. But now you have all these different fears. Is my child going to be religious? So I think for me as parents, we constantly have to adapt to our children's needs, emotional needs, intellectual needs, social needs, in the role that is supportive as opposed to confrontational. So I'll explain that. Confrontational means, you know, imposing things that you think should be in a certain way, while supportive means, you know, making sure that you're putting their well-being in the front. So easier said than done. I'm also an African parent. So, but at least when you think about that, another thing is connection. I think whatever phase your child is, if you maintain that connection, because I've dealt with adolescents where it's very different where you have an adolescent or a child who is experiencing challenges, but they're still connected to their parents. You're better off arguing with your child, screaming at each other, than just having that child who has just completely shut down. They go to their room, they've lost their trust. They can't tell you how they feel. So I think to me, the connection is important, that at whatever point, you know, maintaining that connection, that at least you can still talk. And yeah, it's a continuous process because we are also adapting to a new environment. We've lost our social support once we move into the diaspora. Even our status, you know, here, I can assure you, this cup of tea was not made by me. So I'll find myself having to do stuff for myself. Your status in the society changes. So that's another layer of changes or trauma that you're having to deal with. So as a psychologist, I think personal growth is lifelong. If you're going to live up to 80 or 90, you will still be growing with every challenge that comes. I'll give an example, which I think most of you will identify with. I'm not a fan of the royal family, but I indulge in it for entertainment, and they wear very nice clothes. So, you know, towards the end of her death, the queen, I mean, she had a lot of experiences, but the challenge that, you know, the Harry and Meghan issue brought was very different, you know? So there is no point in life where I think you'd say, you know what, I'm wise, I've grown. Anything can come. So at that point in her 80s, she had to learn to deal with that family dynamic. So what do I do with my grandchild who is experiencing this? So if you also approach parenting in that way or life in that way, to say it's lifelong growth, we'll have different lived experiences at every phase in our life and just be adaptable.
Thank you so much. And last but not the least for Dr. Emily, we also have like a couple of questions that we'll take right after her. From Mrs. Cherokee will be, mental health stigma, especially among African diasporas? How do we equip ourselves to be more open to admitting that my child might need to be, or I might need to be on medications for depression or bipolar or schizophrenia? How do we break down that stigma and equip parents, especially in the diaspora?
Sorry, is that two questions?
I think it's one question. It's just the stigma, mental health stigma around psychotropic medications, and especially for those in the diaspora, right, and of African descent.
Yeah, this is something I think about quite a bit, because it is well known. It is quite well known that minorities, and actually, I don't think it's just diaspora minorities. I think it's also just like Black Americans, Black British people, who are historically sort of British or American, have a historically lower rate of. Motarani, you've explored this in some of your research, I think, yeah, haven't you? Just the low health seeking. Uh-huh. Rates, even for physical health problems, uh-huh. Right?
Before you cancer get, is too. Yeah, it's everywhere. Yeah.
Before you even get to psychiatry, like even for physical health problems, there's already a sort of reduction in low health seeking, in healthy, and it's different. You know, in the UK, you can probably attribute it to socioeconomic factors. In the UK, and in the US, I mean, in the UK, where healthcare is free in the NHS, you know, it's like, okay, that's, you can't just say socioeconomic factors, right? So some of it is just about sort of cultural ideas as well, and suspiciousness of the healthcare system and all of that sort of thing. So yeah, it's a big problem. How to fix it is a trickier question, because it's something that is just sort of being acknowledged and starting to be looked into. I think at a personal level, which I suppose is the level we can, you know, I mean, like, I don't think there's much value here going into like the policy level. But at a personal level, what we can do is just for the people around us that we know and care about, just so having these conversations with them, talking to them. I think something I found very helpful is sharing our own experiences of seeking mental health care. So I'm quite open about the fact that I've had therapy and that sort of thing. And I find that that's really helpful for people. Sometimes you just saying that is enough to get them thinking, especially if you have a good enough relationship with them, you know, to think, oh, well, if this person who I know and hopefully have some respect for has done this, then, you know, maybe it's not something out of scope for me to do. So yeah, some of it is just talking about our experiences, talking about what it's like, pushing back on sort of the negative ideas when they come up, is probably also helpful. And then just having honest chats about like mental health, just like, you know, not when I say mental health now, not just like psychiatric issues, but just like emotions and feelings and all that sort of thing. And normalizing emotional reactions to things like, you know, grief. Although to some extent, I would say, to be honest, I feel like that's something we do quite well, actually. I don't know about in the UK, in the US, but in the UK, there can be quite a bit of, you know, reluctance to express emotion that I think for us is quite normal. Even where we feel like, and like, again, that's not to say that there aren't ways we can't do better. Actually, I feel like we kind of do that. Like culturally, we're quite good at actually creating space for things like mourning and things like that, in ways that are not as common here. So I think another aspect is just sort of looking at what can we learn, and also what can we bring to the cultures we find ourselves in, and sort of thinking about it from that angle, because we do have things to bring as well, and to offer and to share. I think that's, I don't know if that's helpful, but yeah.
No, I think it's very helpful, because it starts, I think for this would be more of a bottom-up approach. We can talk about policies from now, but you doing that comparing of the healthcare infrastructure in the US and the UK, even with in places where in the US we still have a little bit of the NHIS model, with the veterans and those that are Medicaid, we still find that you find a lot of Blacks and minorities still not seeking those free services. So it's got to be more than just not the availability of it. There's just some personal contextual factors. And spot on using ourselves as an example. I've been very vocal on this podcast. I've even had a conversation on IMED on it. I've been in therapy since maybe I'm coming up on my 10th year anniversary as a with my therapist. And then, which has really been very good for me as an immigrant moving here and just seeing some of the things popping out. I've also been on meds for anxiety and depression. I stopped using it because of memory issues, but it really helped me when it did. And so being normalizing that and just saying, even going on meds was a big issue for me because I had a lot of questions about how is it going to destroy my neural pathway. And I've had this conversation with Ayurveda, and it just came down to if you're asthmatic, you won't be questioning you getting addicted to your asthma inhaler. Why should it be any different for, you know, taking medication if your brain is broken? And so here's just the support. It's okay to say you're not okay, but seek that level of help you need. If you have to be on meds, do your due diligence on the side effect and what is it going to profit you? How long do you have to be on it for? But all that to say, it's okay if you need to get on meds or do therapy and medications or just therapy alone or medications, whatever works for you. And don't think therapy is a cop-out. You guys have no idea how much unpacking you have to do. It's a lot of work to expose yourself to someone and hoping that they're on the other side to, like, you know, scoop you up and help you with that. Down to one of our very last questions would be from the wonderful country of Zambia, and this is one of my podcast sisters, Chulu Chansa. She wants to ask about how parents can be well equipped with working with the school units in basically building relationships to avoid suicide in the kids. So how do we partner up with teachers to help our children not be suicidal? So that parent teacher connection, how do we do that? And I will toss it up to any of the panelists to answer.
I'd like to speak to that, but okay, also throw in faith communities as well. And maybe especially actually, obviously where people are faith practicing, if you're not, then that's, you know, you can look for other social avenues, but other social sort of third places. In terms of partnering with schools, I think lots of teachers are trained in these sorts of things, including even in like back home as well. Obviously, that's probably done better in the West. But I know that in Nigeria and a lot of African countries, that's starting to be a thing that people are becoming more and more aware of. Obviously, they also have other challenges, including the fact that they probably have like five times more students. And so just practically, it's just going to be harder, period. If you have 50 students versus if you have 15, to sort of look at their mental health. And, you know, I can't really blame anybody who struggles with the bigger number. But I think people are trying. I think a good part of it is just the basics that I think parents have always done, which is have as good a relationship as you can with your kids' teachers, know your kids' friends where you can, and have conversations with them. I know a friend of mine found out that her son was having some quite dark thoughts through a friend of the son's who came to this parent and said, look, he's not talking to me and something's going on, you know. And this again goes back to the community thing, right? So it was the friend. And this was a school friend, which is why I'm bringing that up here. It was the friend who was able to sort of spot it. But then the friend knew the parents enough. And again, that tells you a lot of what work has gone on in the background to feel comfortable to say, I'm going to talk to this guy's mom because I'm not able to talk to the guy. So it's stuff like that. But the reason why I would highlight other communities, whether that's social clubs, whether that's, you know, religious faith communities, is there's something I think about when people aren't being paid to do this. So for teachers, that's their job, they're paid. And God bless them. It's not that the being paid makes them do a worse job, but once you're paid, it becomes a professional relationship. So an example I think about often is if I have a young person at my job who is, you know, struggling, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to hug them because
without getting just fired.
That's not how that relationship
you can,
works.
You can like, hug. Like, it's just
no, but I can't actually.
I know.
I mean,
there have been once or twice when like a patient hugged me and I allowed it, but it's something you sort of think very carefully, and it would never be an opposite sex patient. Like, just that one's completely off the table. Like, we're even talking, like, even for the same sex patients, it's you have to really think about it, and it's mostly not going to happen. And I was thinking about the fact that, but if it was like a kid at church, straight up, like, it's not even a consideration. You know, again, I would probably not for the opposite sex case, but for like one of the boys, like, you know, and they're struggling. I've done that so many times. And remember the day I had this thought was one day when one boy was particularly struggling, I just went around him and sort of held him around the shoulder while he was crying. I was like, are you okay? Do you want to talk? And I was just thinking about, I couldn't do this at work. Right? And this is the limitation of those professional relationships. Not because those people don't want to do it, because in my case, I'm the same person. But when you're being paid, it's just there's a difference in that relationship, because now it's professional and it can be personal in that way. Whereas in those other settings, they can be personal in a way that you can't be in those sort of more professional relationships. And I think that's also because I think there's a tendency to sort of hyper-focus on schools and forget the value of these third spaces where you can have more personal relationships with young people. And again, that can allow for a level of connection. Now, obviously, whatever the context, whether it's school or whatever, there's always risk. And I think people get worried a lot about, you know, grooming and all of this. And those are real. I think the problem, though, is you don't hear all the times that these relationships go really well. And I think all of us would probably have had these experiences with older adults when we're younger that were really helpful. But people don't talk about it because it just, there's nothing to talk about. So there's that bias of like when it goes wrong, you hear those stories and everybody is thinking about that all the time. And so there are people who generally will not let their kids interact with anybody else. And I get the fear because obviously, you know, you're the parent. But the truth is it goes right so many times. But there's nothing to talk about, so it doesn't make the news. You know, like someone said, dog bites man is not news. It's when is man bites dog. that you have the news, right? So, you know, nobody talks about all the times the other, nothing happens because nothing happened. You know, it was just a kid with an adult and things went well and the kid was getting mentorship and all of that. So I think those third spaces are really important to think about is all I'm saying.
Thank you so much. And it's funny how we kind of know how to behave in so like professional and personal settings, but it's like the first time I'm actually, you know, visualizing like, yeah, I can't hug a student, but if that student of the same age was in my church, I could give them a hug and not think twice about it. But it's the same, you know, age demographic. But I love that advice of diversifying our communities. And we started with talking about mental health, but we ended up talking about community. And it's just a running joke between Amida and I, especially when it comes on the podcast, that you can't just do life alone. You have to find a way to make sure that you are in community. And whatever that might look like for you, whether it's through religious organizations or that shared interest, do that. And that's one model that I'm trying to give my daughter to understand the power of community. So she's very much immersed in that. She knows that we're not self-made people. We have had people, you know, show us love and we reciprocate that. That's how we relive life. My final question for all of you will be this. We're seeing a lot of people, our community, African communities, we're so good on that, you know, transgenerational sharing of wisdom, but that's becoming more fragmented. And I think a stark reminder of that for me was I lost my last living grandparent last year and I couldn't even make it home for the burial. And I hadn't seen her before then in a decade. We talk once in a while on the phone, but the way she would talk to me and address me, it felt very distant for me. I mean, she would call me my pet name, which no one ever calls me that. She was the only one who would call me that. But the more I was away from home, the more it felt very distant talking to this person. It wasn't quite as warm on my end, but she would, but it evoked some form of responses from me. And she eventually passed away. And that was my last surviving grandparent. And you're seeing that happening, even with parents sending their, you know, wards abroad to go study. And you're seeing that the family unit just getting more fragmented. And that also impacts communication and sharing down values. How do we ensure we still stay intact, even when we're so far away? You know, that will be my final challenging question to all of the panelists.
That's a challenge. I think as much as we want to remain intact, I think of family, like, so, you know, the image of the family tree. Typically the family tree is like trying to figure out how everyone is related. But if we made an analogy with the actual tree, it starts with the roots, right? The heritage, where we're collecting everything. And then you have the branch as kind of the core identity. The trunk, that's the core identity. And then you have branches, right? So everyone, and the branches are the farthest from the root, and they go in different directions. But they're still connected to the roots somehow. But grafting happens, right? Sometimes you like cut off a part of a branch and you put it into another tree, and it still thrives, right? So all that to say, like, there should be safety, and there should be normal conversation around chosen family, and like the way that values can change, and that's not a bad thing. I will speak from my experience. Sometimes I'm shamed for not speaking Hausa as much or not knowing my parents' tribal language. But there are things that my chosen family here have given me that my roots haven't. So like safety in expressing my emotions and, you know, and mental health, and finding values that that I want to replicate, that I otherwise would not have developed if I wasn't around my chosen family. So there is a lot to grieve in not having that kind of intact tree pre-grafting. But I think it's healthy to grieve that and acknowledge it and still know that while that's there, chosen family is just as valuable, you know? And like the disconnect happens when we don't allow ourselves to grieve what could have been if we didn't migrate, you know?
For that analogy with the roots and the branches and just the role to play. Thank you so much. I am going to expand on that.
No, I love that. I love that. I love the idea of, you know, allowing ourselves mourning. I love it because also it's a, you know, it's like a little pun of also allowing yourself to mourn, but also allowing yourself to wait for the morning, right? roll your eyes. But yeah, but that's really important. I think it's the recognition that family can, you know, again, if we're thinking in terms of community, like, you know, yes, let's be grateful for the communities we leave behind, but let's also be open to the communities that are waiting for us where we are, and acknowledge, you know, one of my uncles when I was younger used to say to me that, you know, there's this Yoruba proverb, which, you know, like 20 children cannot play together for 20 years, you know, and it's sort of just this idea that life is in seasons, like people will come and people will go and it's okay, right? Like it's okay. And some people will not go, but I think it's sort of, I think the way I've come to think about it is that apart from like the closest family, there's an aspect to life where we allow ourselves to see who's what rather than determining beforehand, this person will never go. And yeah, we can determine that for some people because, this person is special enough that they will never go. And I will always try and hold on to this relationship as much as I can. But even then, you still have to give yourself the space to allow the relationship to evolve in its different ways. But also technology, right? Like, I'm so glad for the times we live in. Like the fact that we can even have this conversation. Imagine trying to set this up 20 years ago, right? Like, it's not like it would have been impossible, but it would have needed a lot more tech support, right? And 40, 50 years ago, it would have to have been like a very expensive conference call and even more tech support. And now it's just free. I mean, you're paying your internet bill, but you're going to pay that anyway, so it doesn't really count. You know what I mean? So I think it's amazing that we get to do this, you know, like, you know, anytime when you can talk to your family back home every day or every week and you're not looking at your call credit and so, okay, I'm going to call them for 2 minutes. I still remember growing up and like, you know, like you call people abroad and you'd be like, look, you have 2 minutes think about what you're going to say very carefully, right? Because, and then, you know, but now you can just chat to somebody for like an hour or 2 hours and just start about nonsense. And that's amazing. You know, we often talk about like, it's beautiful to have face-to-face, and it is. But you know what's great when you can't have face-to-face? It's technology. And that's amazing. So like, let's make the most of that. Let's, you know, one of the things I've tried to do, a friend of mine advised this, is for my niece and nephew back in Nigeria. So yeah, this might be a good idea, actually. I got this idea from a friend. It's just one of the most creative people I know. I don't know till she came up with this idea by herself. And I feel like I've really hyped it. And it was basically like, every now and then, I will send my niece and nephew pictures from my day-to-day life. Not pictures of myself, just like random silliness that I see around me, where I am. And then every now and then, when I've sent them like enough of those pictures, they will call me and they will ask me about the pictures. They will ask you about, okay, what's happening in that picture? What were you doing? What is going on? And it's sort of this idea of like, you know, I'm like Uncle Emilio over up in the UK, but I'm a real presence for them. Like hopefully they grew up and they remember that they had this uncle used to send like weird pictures, right? And it was something that they were very excited. So like every now and then I'll forget and I'll get busy. And then like the mom will be texting me. That's, you know, like my sister-in-law, like, when we need more pictures, man. What's up with them pictures? You know, and it's like, it's not her asking, it's the kids asking and saying, well, where's Uncle Abide's pictures? We need pictures. And that's the moment I realized, oh my goodness, they're actually waiting for this now. This is like a thing, you know. And so, yeah, God knows what other ideas people could come up with. So there's all sorts of little ways. And again, that's technology, right? Because now we have these cameras in our pockets that can take really amazing, sort of high quality photos and videos, compared to the grainy stuff from when we were growing up, you know. So yeah, I think thinking about how we can creatively use technology is a wonderful way we can try and sustain these connections across distances as well.
Thank you so much for that. Dr. Michelle, do you want to add anything to?
Not much. Just to say that just finding ways to compensate for the feeling of isolation and loss of identity. And as Dr. Ayomide and Dr. Puri say, it's really just appreciating where you come from and making the best of where you are, because we all leave our homes for a reason, and it's not a decision that you make impulsively. So yes, just finding a way to feel the curving a new identity. I mean, I'm blessed. I feel blessed. I've literally found a new community here. Something that I never expected, you know. So it's the same thing. Just find a way to deal with the isolation, compensating, finding different ways to connect. And I like the idea of finding a new family, as Dr. Puri put it. Finding family in others. And family doesn't have to be, you know, blood family, but anyone who embraces you, who makes you feel welcome and, you know, puts you in a place where, you know, you're thriving. That's family to me.
Thank you so much. We have talked a lot today. Unfortunately, our time is very well spent, but I will, if you follow the Mossable podcast, also find out our YouTube channel on YouTube and Instagram at the Mossable podcast. We will be putting just the summary of this episode. And also, if you'd like to get in touch with me or any of the panelists, you can just email me at talktomore@mossable.com, and I'll be more than happy to introduce you to any of the panelists. Or for those that are publicly available, you guys just shout out your Instagram handles or email addresses. I can start with Dr. Ayomide. I know you're out there. You're outside.
Okay, yeah, mine is, you know, at X now. We have to call it X, don't we?
Sounds like a drug.
I was going to say it sounds like something inappropriate. But yes, I'm at Dr. Ayomide on the X app, and also on Threads if you're into that. I don't know if people are into that yet. But yeah. And hello at drayomide.com if you want to send me an email. Join drayomide.com for my newsletter.
Mm.
And mine is materomichelle@gmail.com. I am very old school, so I'm not a very social media person, but on Instagram, mate-michelle2021. But on LinkedIn, I'm very much there most of the time, and you can message me on LinkedIn as well.
Got it. Thank you so much. And I'll put all of that in the show notes. Dr. Pierre?
Yeah, Michelle, I'm right there with you. You can reach me on email. You email me. Just find me on LinkedIn. Well, my email is jessica.puri@northwestern.edu. Or LinkedIn. It's just my full name, Jessica Puri, PhD, MPH. Fun fact, I am the only Black Jessica Puri. All the others are Indian. So you'll see my Black face. There you
go. That is true. Puri is like, I'm so curious where your surname comes from.
I have no idea. Our clan name, I think, is like Nipuri, and my family decided to keep it. But like, it's actually like, there's a town in India called Jagannath Puri. There's a kind of bread called Puri.
I know Puris actually, but
I show up and they're like, huh? I'm like, yeah. And then they know I'm married. And so they see my husband, who's a beautiful, tall Black man whose last name is Buckley. And they're like, well, you're not. So where is Puri from? So,
And the person who introduced me to you was Indian as well. So I thought you were Indian when they were talking about it. I was like, she had to be Indian. And I was like, wait, what? Is she the other Black looking Indian? Anyways, so thank you all so much. This has just been a hearty conversation. And spot on what Dr. Michelle said, this is community right here. And we hope that you all take this with you and start making your life happen for you and not living life alone. As a round off, I just wanted to highlight one of the big things we're doing on the podcast. We're raising funds for women who have been challenged with fertility issues. We're raising $10,000 to provide not just financial aid, but peer mentoring and support, emotional support services. Every contribution goes a long way. If you'd like to donate your services or your time or money, I'm putting the link on the show, on the chat. And then as we just go, I just want to add that this preventing suicide in those we love, it involves not just our own effort, but we need to be in community for that to happen, right? So what are things I'm going to leave you with based on what our wonderful panelists said? Challenging the not my kid mindset. Watch out for cues. I know in this part of the world where we're so burdened with our 9-to-5 and 5-to-9 work, sometimes we're blindsided on how our kids are just growing, you know, without and outside of us, but challenging that not my kid mentality, having conversations, checking in on them about their emotions, labeling the emotions, creating that diverse support systems, right? Embracing the communities of the past and present, understanding what your own limitations are, grow emotionally with your child, foster those very support network, cultivate emotional awareness, be mindful as parents. It's okay, you're heavily flawed, that's okay. Your kids will become heavily flawed parents, but that shouldn't stop the buck. You know, seek help if you need, be on meds if you have to be on meds. Recognize just the cultural impacts of mental health, the baggage you bring with you, especially if you're moving across countries. Address those unresolved traumas, seek support, and start opening those dialogues. Ayomide Short shared about that book, How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. That's a very good resource, and it was published in 1980, so you know it's got to be a good book, right? In any event, this has been a production from the Morsible Podcast. We have conversations like this. As a matter of fact, this topic was inspired by, you know, Jessica, who was a guest. So if there are other ways we can serve you as our community, please let us know. We take those comments very, very seriously. And we promise to populate those voices by bringing in people who will be able to speak to those topics. So reach out to us on email talktomo@morsible.com or follow us on Instagram at the Morsible Podcast. I'm so thankful for each of you for joining us on this Saturday morning, afternoon, evening, whatever part of the world you're in. And a great weekend to you. And please stay safe. I remember you really matter. And thank you all so much. Bye-bye, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this, Mo.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was great.
Thank you. I'll check in with you all.
Good to be on. Again, Jessica.